17 seconds and counting. Guidance internal. 15, 14, 13, 12, 11, 10, 9. We have ignition sequence start. Engines on. 5, 4, 3, 2. All engines running.
Because that challenge is one that we're willing to accept, one we are willing to postpone, and one we intend to win.
Okay, engine stop. ATA at a descent. Flight control both auto, descent engine command override off. Engine arm on. 413 is in.
We come to get down, Eagle.
Houston, Tranquility Base here. The Eagle has landed.
The Hubble Space Telescope has been orbiting the Earth and doing great science for the past 25 years. With us today on Cosmic Perspective is Goddard Space Flight Center Senior Project Scientist Dr. Jennifer Wiseman to talk to us about Hubble's remarkable 25-year history and its contributions to science. Dr. Wiseman, thanks for joining us today.
My pleasure.
25 years, it's hard to believe that Hubble has been giving us these beautiful images and unlocking the secrets of the cosmos for 25 years now. What many of us don't know is that for quite some time, we weren't even sure if the Hubble was going to get off the ground.
First of all, thank you for your warm words, and I think the Hubble Space Telescope anniversary that we're celebrating is really a time of celebration and pride for everyone, certainly NASA, but also the European Space Agency is a partner in Hubble, and all the people around the country and the world who have been supporters of Hubble and really interested in what we're learning from Hubble. So it's really a worldwide celebration of what we've learned with Hubble, and it's really fun to be a part of that today since Hubble is still working so well. But you're absolutely right that at Hubble's beginning, things didn't always go so smoothly. And in fact, there were these terrible disasters with the space shuttle, which brought delays into all of the shuttle, the subsequent shuttle missions. Hubble was due to launch in the 80s on the space shuttle, and because of the space shuttle Challenger disaster, that launch was delayed until 1990. But thankfully, Hubble did launch in 1990 on the space shuttle, and it's been in orbit around the Earth ever since.
Yes, it has, and we certainly have gained a wealth of knowledge from Hubble over the past 25 years. And as you've said, this is a worldwide celebration. The efforts of many have kept the Hubble up and running for 25 years. And there were challenges to the Hubble team right from the very start. Shortly after it was released into space, the Hubble had a problem with its primary mirror.
Yes, there was so much anticipation leading up to Hubble's launch. Everyone around the world, and certainly NASA, was anticipating these beautiful, sharp images from space. But the first images we got down were kind of disappointing. They were a little bit blurry. They really weren't of the quality that was expected. And it turns out there was a problem in the way the mirror and the telescope had been produced. It was having a problem we call spherical aberration. This was a huge disappointment. And it led to some real soul-searching and head-scratching and, thankfully, some creative energy on the part of engineers and technicians and government leaders and NASA leaders. And a solution was arrived at, and it involved kind of putting corrective optics on Hubble. So 3 years later, in 1993, an astronaut crew was launched back to Hubble and put in corrective optics. And in fact, all the instruments put in on Hubble ever since have these corrective optics built in. They completely correct for the problem with the mirror. And ever since 1993, we've had absolutely spectacular data coming down from Hubble.
So the primary mirror wasn't replaced. A redesign of the optics were installed, kind of like giving eyeglasses to the Hubble, I guess?
Exactly. We put kind of corrective glasses on Hubble for the instruments that were already on board, and then for future instruments, we built those corrective optics in. And in fact, since all the newer instruments that are on board now that have been installed by astronauts in subsequent servicing missions have those corrective optics, we don't really need those eyeglasses on Hubble anymore. So the astronauts on the last servicing mission they did in 2009 brought the corrective optics back down with them, something called COSTAR, and it's on display right now in the National Air and Space Museum in Washington, D.C.
I'd like to talk about the astronauts' role in the Hubble servicing missions. Some of the parts of the Hubble were not designed to be repaired, and what many of us may not know is that the astronauts risked their lives to maintain, upgrade, and keep it operational for the past 25 years so that we can all enjoy this great science given to us by the Hubble.
All missions in space have some danger. We're, you know, our human bodies are mainly built to be here on planet Earth, so we have to take some risk to go into space. But the astronauts have all felt that it's worth it to do the kinds of things they do to give us the kinds of science that Hubble brings us. And in fact, the Hubble was designed to be serviced by astronauts. That it was brought up by the space shuttle, and it was put into low Earth orbit, which means it's not that far off the ground. It's an altitude about 340 miles orbiting around, and that's an accessible orbit for low Earth orbit missions like the space shuttle. And so several missions have repeatedly gone back to Hubble to service it, upgrade it, and it was designed for this. So we didn't really even know from the outset how long Hubble would last, given that we could service it. It was thought maybe we might make it to 15 years, and now we're at 25. So we're thrilled it's still working better than ever. What some of the instruments, however, what we hadn't planned for is actually repairing individual instruments on board if they malfunctioned. The idea was you'd bring in new instruments, which we have done. But we've also been able to have the astronauts do some tricky repairs, and I think that's what you're referring to. Those were the kinds of things that weren't always planned in advance, and sometimes the instruments weren't designed to be handled in a space environment. So astronauts, even with their big bulky gloves on, have done some heroic deeds by unscrewing screws and bolts and things, taking out malfunctioning electronics and replacing them on instruments on board. And that's why we have just a fantastic suite of instruments operating on Hubble right now. Some of them are new as of the last servicing mission, and some of them have been repaired. And together we have this terrific toolkit for science on board Hubble.
And with this great toolkit, the Hubble Space Telescope has produced some phenomenal images, imaging not only in the visible range of light, but a range of light that's not visible to humans.
That's correct. In fact, the newest camera on Hubble, the Wide Field Camera 3, which was developed at NASA Goddard Space Flight Center and installed in 2009, is what we call a panchromatic camera. What that means is it can see colors all the way from near-infrared wavelengths of light through the visible spectrum that our eyes could see and into ultraviolet. And then we also have a spectrograph, which takes the light that Hubble collects and stretches it out into its component colors. And we have two spectrographs. And with the spectrographic capability on Hubble, we can also peer into ultraviolet light as well. So Hubble sees things in many colors, including those that our eyes wouldn't normally see. And that's very helpful to us, astronomically speaking, because many phenomena in space are showing themselves active through non-visible colors. For example, the aurorae on planets in our solar system. We now know there are aurorae on Jupiter and Uranus and several other planets, and those are visible in ultraviolet light. often the emission between galaxies, what we call the cosmic web, this wispy hot gas and around galaxies and that connects galaxies, that's most easily detected in ultraviolet light. You can say the same about infrared light, which is on the other side of the visible spectrum. The infrared or lower energy light is a better tool if you want to see distant galaxies that are redshifted as they move apart with the stretching of space. Some of those are moving so fast that the light is shifted into these stretched, reddened wavelengths, and we can see them better with Hubble's infrared channel on the Wide Field Camera 3. And you can also use infrared light to see into some of these dusty clouds and nebulae where new stars are forming, kind of gets us behind some of that dusty veil that would otherwise block the view. So you're right, the suite of colors that Hubble is able to detect is one of its great strengths.
I'd like to talk a little bit about some of these breathtaking images. Being a NASA outreach volunteer for many years, when I do public outreach events, there isn't anything that really excites people more than Hubble Space Telescope images. One of my favorites, I have to say, is Pillars of Creation. I'm sure there have been many, many images taken by Hubble. I'm not sure how many. But there are some greatest hits, I believe, and I think that's one of them.
Some of the most spectacular images from Hubble are these beautiful interstellar clouds and nebulae. Sometimes they show these stark pillars. Those are caused when recently formed massive stars, which are burst in these dense clouds of dust and gas, will shine bright radiation and stellar winds back into the environment out of which they formed, and that will kind of blow away the less dense material and leave behind the denser pockets of gas and dust. And those dense regions left behind look like these long pillars. And of course, because they are so dense, they're actually prime sites for subsequent star formation. All a star is just a little ball of gas and dust that collapses under its own gravitational weight. And so in these dense pillars, we actually find sometimes young stars on the route to formation. We call them protostars. And thanks to Hubble's infrared observing capabilities, we can see some of those protostars. We can see behind the dusty veil in these columns and see the young stars. In fact, that famous nebula you mentioned, the Eagle Nebula, which was produced in 1995 and is one of the world's favorite Hubble images, we redid that observation last year in 2014. And with the new camera on Hubble. And so you can see that wonderful region in more precision, more detail, and even in infrared light where you can see into those pillars. So it's a spectacular place to look if you want to see a fabulous Hubble image. And by the way, Hubble images are all available at a website called hubblesite.org, or you can go to www.nasa.gov/Hubble and find all of these things.
Yes, I have seen the image that was done in last year. It was remarkable. And just, yeah, like you said, the Hubble's been updated. The resolution is better. It sees further into the universe. That image is a great image to see after 24 years.
It is, and we're proud of it. And in fact, this week we've released another fabulous image from Hubble to celebrate its 25th anniversary. And it's another one of these stellar nurseries where a cluster of stars has recently formed, and the radiation and winds from those stars are chiseling into the surrounding gas and just making a spectacular montage of information.
You are listening to Cosmic Perspective with my guest today, Dr. Jennifer Wiseman, Senior Project Scientist at Goddard Space Flight Center. When we come back, we'll discuss the Hubble Space Telescope's greatest hits of scientific discoveries over the past 25 years, and the Hubble's predecessor, the James Webb Telescope. Next are some comments and highlights of NASA astronaut Michael Good's experiences on the final Hubble Space Telescope servicing mission.
It was a special mission, and a bonus to get something like that on my first mission, you know, ever. So it was fun to be a part of that, a great team effort to go back to the Hubble for the last time and really turn it into a brand new telescope again. I did two spacewalks on that mission with my partner, Mike Massimino. We did five spacewalks total. We had two teams of spacewalkers, four of us total, and two would go out And they did 1, 3, and 5, and then Mass and I went out and did spacewalks 2 and 4. So we did 5 spacewalks in 5 consecutive days up there, and that was the meat of the mission. Although, you know, I don't like to say that in front of the commander. I mean, there were things like launch and landing and rendezvous and other stuff like that, but we like to think the spacewalks were the fun part. Yeah, it's amazing. I think so many people know about Hubble, and it is very popular. I mean, even, you know, the kids in the schools. And, you know, we didn't go to repair it just for the astronomers and the astrophysicists, but it's for everybody. It's everybody's telescope. It's really an international telescope, and it's for the teachers and students, and hopefully it'll motivate some kids to be our next engineers and scientists.
We're back to continue our discussion with Dr. Jennifer Wiseman on the 25th anniversary of the Hubble Space Telescope. What I'd like to talk about next is the discoveries that Hubble has made, and I'm wondering if you could kind of give us maybe like a greatest hits of the last 25 years of Hubble discoveries.
Sure. Well, it is very challenging to try to quickly encompass all the discoveries of Hubble because it's a general purpose observatory. It's used for everything from solar system observations to looking at the most distant galaxies. But there are a few things that stand out, I think. First of all, Hubble was designed as one of its main goals to measure the expansion rate of the universe. You know, thanks to Edwin Hubble and his colleagues and peers, we knew that the universe was expanding and is expanding, but the actual rate of that expansion and the related age of the universe calculation was a bit unclear with observations from the ground. But with Hubble, we could calibrate much better the distances to other galaxies, and that, along with information about their apparent receding velocities away from us, can tell us the expansion rate of the universe. So that is one of the first major projects that was taken on with Hubble, and that rate of expansion was measured by Wendy Friedman and her team, and determined to be, we have a constant we call the Hubble constant, which is a measure of that rate of expansion, and she measured that to a precision never before possible. Now, that then correlated to an age of the universe, and the age, if you kind of rewind the tape to bring the expansion rate back to when that expansion might have started, gave an age of something like between 9 and 12 billion years, which was problematic because from stellar astrophysics, we knew there were some stars that were older than that, so you couldn't have stars that were older than the universe itself. But as the years went on and a lot more study went into this, we realized that there's more going on in cosmology than we knew. There's dark matter, there's dark energy, the universe, the expansion of the universe is actually accelerating. So all that feeds into a better age estimate that we now have of something like 13.8 billion years. But anyway, that's one of the major accomplishments of Hubble, is helping us to really hone down the expansion rate and the age of the universe. We also used Hubble early on to investigate the centers of other galaxies. It was speculated that there might be something very mysterious and energetic in the cores of many galaxies. Some of them were sending out these powerful jets, but from what? We didn't know. Maybe a massive black hole. But there was no way to measure that until we had Hubble. And Hubble was used to look at the cores of other galaxies. The first one of these was one called M87, and to see what was going on way down in there. And because of Hubble's high angular resolution, you can see a lot of detail. And what we saw with Hubble in the core of this galaxy, M87, was that the gas right near the middle of this galaxy was moving very fast in orbital motion. So the gas on one side of the center of the galaxy was moving very quickly away from us, and the gas on the other side of the center of this galaxy was moving very fast toward us, millions of miles an hour, just very fast. And it turns out that the only thing that could hold such gas in such a tight orbit at such velocities would be a huge mass in a small volume, and all that can be is a supermassive black hole. So we discovered without question that there's a supermassive black hole in the core of M87. And now we know there are supermassive black holes at the cores of maybe most galaxies. So that's a big advance from Hubble as well. We've learned that our own solar system is dynamic, that comets and asteroids collide with not only planets, but sometimes with each other. And we have discovered, I think, by looking at very distant galaxies and comparing them with our own, that galaxies change over time, and that over cosmic history, we've had generations of stars come and go in these galaxies that have enriched them with heavier and heavier elements. Galaxies have merged together and created larger galaxies. So we've seen a kind of progression of complexity in the universe over time, and Hubble has played a large role in that.
The last servicing mission, I believe, for the Hubble was in 2009.
That's right.
And now that the space shuttle program has come to an end, it seems that there isn't any other or further Hubble servicing missions that are very likely to happen.
That's right. So Hubble was designed to basically work hand-in-hand with the space shuttle program. The space shuttle was responsible for deploying the telescope in the very beginning at its launch in 1990, and then several times astronauts over these 25 years have returned to Hubble on the space shuttle, and it's a nice fit. The shuttle goes up, there's a robotic arm that would latch on to the satellite and pull it into the payload bay, and then astronauts could go out in their spacesuits and do extravehicular activity and put in new instruments or repair things as needed. So that's gone on several times. That's kept the telescope in tip-top shape, and that's why Hubble is in tip-top shape right now, thanks to the last servicing mission that was very successful. But since the space shuttle is no longer operating, we don't have any plans for future servicing of Hubble. So while we are thrilled that Hubble is working very well right now, it really is at the peak of its scientific capability right now, even after 25 years, we know this won't last forever because we can't service it anymore. So we're hoping, our little motto is Hubble 2020. We're hoping that Hubble operates well at least till 2020 and hopefully for quite a few years beyond that.
Well, the good news is that the Hubble Space Telescope has a successor, the James Webb Telescope. Can you tell us a little bit about the James Webb Telescope?
Sure. NASA's very focused right now on developing and building another major space telescope. And this James Webb Space Telescope, named after a very prominent NASA administrator, will be launched in 2018. And so our hope is that these two telescopes will overlap some because they have different capabilities. James Webb will also be a major space astronomy multi-purpose observatory. It will deliver that same or even better quality images that we've come to love from Hubble. But the Webb telescope will be primarily aimed at collecting infrared light. So with infrared light, you can actually learn some things about the universe and objects in space that you can't really learn with just visible light. Now, Hubble also can collect some infrared light and is doing some wonderful science by doing that, but the Webb telescope will see even farther into infrared wavelengths of light, and that allows us to learn things above and beyond what Hubble could tell us in certain areas. The Webb telescope will see that much better than Hubble can at the highest distances. So we're hoping the Webb telescope will show us even more about how the very first stars and galaxies began to form in our early universe. So these two telescopes give us complementary information, and to have both of them will give us a much bigger and broader picture of what's going on in everything from nearby space to very distant galaxies.
Information from Hubble's discoveries have allowed us to more accurately determine the age of the universe. Will the James Webb Telescope be able to see back to the beginning?
Hubble has contributed to helping us understand the age of the universe, but it's not the only instrument. We have We have other telescopes like the Planck telescope, a space telescope, and other facilities in space and on the ground that have all worked together to help us calculate a better estimate for the age of the universe, including, for example, observations of the cosmic microwave background radiation, which is this leftover radiation from the Big Bang itself. And that has been better measured through satellites like WMAP, Wilkinson Microwave Anisotropy Probe, and other things. Anyway, in Planck, these observatories have helped us gauge that 13.8 billion year history of the universe, along with Hubble's ability to gauge the distances and the expansion rate and the acceleration rate of the universe. So all that has worked together. Will the James Webb see all the way back to the beginning of time itself? Well, no, there's a fundamental physical issue there, that the very beginning of time, the burst of light that was of energy that was emitted there, is still enshrouded because the photons cannot escape until after a certain amount of time after the Big Bang. And then at that point where light could begin to escape and be seen, that's what we see when we see the cosmic microwave background radiation. And James Webb isn't even tuned for those frequencies as well. But what it is tuned for is some of these earliest little fragmentary gas and star agglomerations that were basically what we call the seeds of galaxies. And that's what we really want to understand. How early on in the universe did galaxies begin to form? And we think that Webb will see back. Again, I mentioned that Hubble can see back to within the first 0.8 of the 13.8 billion year history of the universe. But we think that Webb will see back even maybe within the first couple of hundred million years after the Big Bang. So it's going to take us a little farther back and help us learn a little bit more in terms of how the universe began to grow and evolve.
It would be wonderful to have the Hubble Space Telescope and James Webb Telescope working together. And there are many other space and ground-based telescopes doing great science. Most of them we haven't even mentioned.
Oh, yeah, there's so many others. I mean, I can't even list them all, but there are many other telescopes in space and on the ground right now that have really important specialties. I'm thinking of the Chandra X-ray Observatory, the Spitzer Space Telescope, other telescopes that have come and gone over the years, but like the Kepler Observatory that's helped us find thousands of extrasolar planets. And then, of course, many great telescopes on the ground. The ALMA Observatory in South America is giving us tremendous views from the point of view of a radio observatory of objects buried in dust and gas in interstellar space. So, and many telescopes, optical telescopes on the ground, Keck, Gemini, Palomar, you name it, many, many others, and they all work together in concert, and we need them all. They all give different kinds of information. Hubble isn't capable of doing everything we need done, so a lot of these telescopes work in complement with Hubble.
Dr. Wiseman, thanks for joining us today to discuss one of the greatest scientific instruments ever made by man, the Hubble Space Telescope, and various other telescopes. Thanks very much for being with us.
It's my pleasure, and we're wishing Hubble a happy 25th birthday this year, so we're glad you can join the celebration.
Yes, it is a time for celebration. 25 years of great science from the Hubble Space Telescope. But there would not be a 25-year Hubble celebration without servicing missions. Thanks to many innovative people on the ground and teams of shuttle astronauts that risked their lives, there were 5 successful servicing missions to the Hubble in total. Each mission saved the telescope from operational failures and added equipment that enabled Hubble to look further into the universe with higher resolution. The final Space Shuttle Hubble servicing mission that put Hubble in tip-top shape in doing great science today was canceled indefinitely by NASA Administrator Sean O'Keefe in 2004. After the Space Shuttle Columbia disaster in 2003. The mission was rescheduled for 2008 after NASA Administrator Michael Griffin proposed and implemented a rescue mission that consisted of another space shuttle on the launch pad and a space shuttle rescue crew ready if needed. The final servicing mission was rescheduled again for launch in 2009 after another component that was not part of the final repair mission failed on the Hubble. Astronaut Mike Massimino shares his most challenging and most memorable experiences on the final Hubble servicing mission, STS-125.
On my second flight on STS-125, we were doing a few things that were a little bit different, which were repairing instruments on site. Usually what we did on the Hubble missions is we would take up a new piece of equipment, you take out the old and put the new one in. It's kind of like if your refrigerator loses its light bulb, you replace the whole refrigerator, that kind of thing. You don't try to go in there and fix it. And I was a little more involved in the light bulb. We had a couple power supplies on two different instruments that had failed. But we had to go inside the instrument. And these instruments were never intended to be fixed in space. So we came up with new techniques and tools to do this. And on this second spacewalk that I was on during that mission to repair this spectrograph, we had to remove a panel with 117 small screws. But one of those screws was contained on a handrail, which we didn't think was going to be a problem. And we couldn't get this screw to come out. And I was very concerned that we would not be able to do the repair of the instrument that we had been practicing for 3 years. And the call came up from the ground to rip off the handrail, just pull it off. And, looking back, and I was able to do that. And ripping off the handrail was actually kind of easy. I'm very good at breaking things. But it was hard to try to, while we were going for about an hour or so, trying to figure out what to do. That was the hard part, trying to stay focused and not lose anything and make things worse and not lose hope that we'd be able to actually get it done. And I think it was a very good example of how people can adapt and fix things that, it's good to have an astronaut hand, where a robot would have been difficult to have them do that. I think it was a very good use of the space shuttle and the crew and the whole team. So that's kind of probably the hardest thing, getting through that time before we knew what the solution was, and then my most memorable time. So what we did is we built like a capture plate that we put on top of the whole panel. Mm-hmm. And then there was some screws that were in different places where we had special tools built that would go over them and capture them. So what we more or less did is we attached a big capture plate to the instrument. I had to take out a couple of the screws very carefully with special tools and put like some mounting brackets on there. And then we were able to mount this big capture plate on top of it. And what that did is that it had holes in it so that I could fit my tool head through there to extract the screw. But the hole was small enough so that the screw would not fly out of there. You know what I mean? So it all kind of got, and then once all the screws are off, then the panel came off with the plate, and the whole thing with the screws floating in between the panel and the plate got shoved into a container and brought home. So it's very clever. I didn't think of it, but it was very clever. You try to finish up within 6.5 hours. Some of the ones I've been on have been closer to 8 hours, but you try to get everything done at 6.5. With Hubble, it was a slightly different situation in that when you're doing the spacewalk on the space station, there are other flights coming up, and now even though this is the last shuttle flight, there's still a crew on board. If you don't get anything done in your spacewalk, there's still a crew there that can finish it up later. Mm-hmm. Or with Hubble, we knew that no one else, especially on STS-125, no one else would be visiting the telescope again, and we want to make sure we got everything done. So if you have to work a little late, a little extra overtime, it's not that bad.
No extra pay for that?
No, I thought I was getting paid by the hours, and then I found out, no, you get paid the same. The thing that failed was actually a computer, an onboard computer that its job was to relay the pictures down to the ground, and I can't even remember the acronym anymore. It's been 2 years. Jeez, terrible. But that computer failed, and we had to replace that. And there was two of them, but it was kind of like all the instruments could work great, and the optics could be perfect, and it's being controlled. But if you can't get the pictures down, it really doesn't do you much good. And that was the holdup with that piece of equipment. So they did have a backup, but they thought it would be wise to they had two of them, in other words. But they didn't want to go down to just one, and that one fails, and you're really out of luck. So they thought it was wise to replace the broken one with a new one and hold off on going to Hubble for a few extra months. It was like a week before I was going into quarantine that happened. I remember getting a call on a Sunday from John Grunsfeld, who was one of my crewmates who was in touch with the folks. He was kind of our spacewalk leader and the most experienced guy, so he stayed in tune what was going on, and he called me as soon as he heard. And I remember I was cleaning out my wife's car, and there's like a list of things you want to get done before you go to space, and that's one of them. I don't know, but I remember sitting in the car, like, you know, cleaning out the crap or whatever was in there, and then John calls me and says, "What are you doing?" I go, "Well," he goes, "Well, guess what?" And he told me what had happened, and then we found out on Monday. You know, like the official word came out. So, yeah, gave us extra time to get ready. It was okay. You know, the scientists can really get into a battle on this because, you know, even, you know, because the spectrographs give you lots of data and stuff. But I kind of like the pictures you see on the calendars and stuff, you know, and you see on album covers and in movies, and they show up everywhere. You know, you see these really beautiful, most of the really spectacular space, deep space pictures that you see come from Hubble. Not all of them, but most of them do. The ones that we say, wow, look at that stuff, you know, and they show up everywhere. It's kind of like part of our culture, you know, seeing these things. And so I think, and the instrument that produces those are the ones that can take these images in the visible light spectrum that give you the actual image. And for a while it was the wide field camera, and then that was replaced by something we put in on SES-109 called the Advanced Camera for Surveys. And that instrument failed, and that was one that we were able to repair. I wasn't outside for the spacewalk. John Grunsfeld, Drew Feusel were outside for that one. But they repaired that instrument and brought that back. So Advanced Camera for Surveys gives us some of these really beautiful pictures we see. And now the newest wide-field camera, which we put on SES-125, is even 10 times more powerful than that one. So, you know, it's kind of like, just think of how your digital cameras have improved over the years. I mean, now I've got something on my phone that is more powerful than anything I've ever had as far as digital camera go. So think about how that's gone over the years. And that's kind of, you know, Hubble has been around for that. And the power of the instruments have kind of led that, actually. It's been a bit ahead of what we have in our pocket, thank goodness. So you have these very powerful optics, these cameras that can take these amazing images of what's out there. And so those are my favorite stuff you can actually see instead of just looking at a bar graph. No offense to the scientists who look at the bar graph.
From all of the hard work and ingenuity that everyone has given on the ground and in space to keep the Hubble operational for 25 years, Mike Massimino sums up in one simple statement what the Hubble has to offer to everyone on this planet.
Yeah, it's great because we can't go there, but Hubble takes us there.
Thanks for joining me for this 25 years of Hubble celebration, 365 days of astronomy podcast. Cosmic Perspective Radio is an Andy Paneros production.